I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is headed to a Hollywood fundraiser at George Clooney's house today, where he'll undoubtedly hear from supporters of his new stand in favor of gay marriage. Polls show a majority of Americans also support gay marriage. But as Touré, the African-American commentator, told us this morning, his mom used to love Ed Bradley until he got an earring. Then she was done because it wasn't manly. Touré writes in Time.com, will Obama also lose these older African-American voters over gay marriage? Syracuse University professor Dr. Boyce Watkins, founder of the Europe Black World Coalition, has also been looking into this. Professor, what are you hearing?
Well, what I'm hearing at Your Black World is that there's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of debate over whether or not there's an agreement with Obama's decision. But the marriage between the black community and President Obama, it's very strong. It's very deep in the sense that there are people that are relentlessly committed to him. And they know, and the president knows, that they don't have any other choices. You see, you can go back into the history of Mitt Romney and find cases where he's advocated for gay rights. But you really can't find anything that says that Mitt Romney will advocate for any of the black agenda or anything that matters to African Americans. So while there are going to be people who adamantly disagree with what the president did, most of those people, when they show up at the polls, are still going to vote for President Obama. And if they don't vote for President Obama, it will probably be because they weren't going to vote for him anyway.
Well, we've spoken about this on the program before, but remind us why this issue is so divisive. We're reading Bill Maxwell, a black commentator in the Tampa Bay Times, writing a year ago about homophobia being a black thing, how in California, 70% of blacks voted for Prop 8, which, of course, constitutionally banned same-sex marriage in California. Blacks were at the forefront of the vote in North Carolina this week against same-sex marriage. Of course, we're not talking about all blacks ever, but could you explain the resistance to gay rights in the black community?
Well, in the black community, there for some, has been a little bit of a resistance to the idea that any other group, especially the gay community, can take advantage of the advances that occurred during civil rights. I disagree with that viewpoint, but I think that to sort of write it off as this blanket homophobia and some kind of ignorance, I think is a little bit disrespectful. All it means really is that the black community, which tends to be deeply religious, very rooted with their church, they have a set of beliefs that tell them that homosexuality is wrong. There are many African-American women who can easily forgive a man for being a philanderer, but they can't forgive him for being gay.
Well, in fact, this discussion came about a few years ago when many found out about something called the Down Low, sort of an underground gay black life. And at the time, we heard from commentators that part of this had to do with something Touré's mom alluded to, dating back to slave times, that, you know, black men had been so abused that it wasn't considered manly to be anything but a strong black heterosexual male. And so that there's something deep here that maybe will be of discussion again.
There could be. I think, though, at the same time, there has to be an acknowledgement that the way African-Americans see homosexuality is a little bit different from the way, say, liberal whites see homosexuality. And really what's coming up is that ugly natural divide between the liberal agenda and the black agenda. There are many African-Americans in the black community who are really closet conservatives, but the Republicans are so racist sometimes that black Americans don't feel comfortable being a part of that party. At the end of the day, black Americans do see homosexuality differently, but their support for Obama is not really going to change that much. And I think the president knows this, and that's why I don't think that the black community is at the top of his worry list on the gay rights issue.
Well, so you say that he might still have the African-American votes, even though, as you put it, blacks don't have the leverage with the president that the gay community does. Again, it just seems like that sense of you're fighting over who gets the most attention to their civil rights. And you write, black America will always end up at the back of the bus, even when our president looks just like us.
Absolutely. The worst thing you can do with any politician is to give them your vote and not ask for anything in return. And that's exactly what the black community has done. It's sort of like paying someone for a job and saying, well, you can show up for work if you feel like it. The black community doesn't have the leverage that the gay community has. because the gay community has made it clear that if the president does not stand with them on this important issue, they're going to abandon him. Black America will not abandon President Obama, period. He could join the KKK, and they still wouldn't abandon him.
Even though you'd love to see him do more on employment inequality, mass incarceration of blacks, educational inequality, issues like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Syracuse University Professor Dr. Bryce Watkins, founder of the Your Black World Coalition. Professor Watkins, it's been fascinating. We're going to have to check in with you again on the road to the election. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you may know that heart disease is the leading killer of men and women, but did you know that if you're exercising like crazy to stave it off, it doesn't matter if you then go sit in an office? In fact, people who don't exercise but move around at work burn many more calories than people who run 35 miles a week but then sit at a desk. And a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic says sitting for more than 4 hours a day gives you the same risk of a heart attack as smoking. Okay, we probably have your attention, so let's spend a few minutes here today. Ron Winslow is Deputy Bureau Chief and Senior Writer for Health and Science at the Wall Street Journal. Ron, this sounds impossible that sitting, you know, even if you're running in the morning, is the same as smoking when it comes to heart disease?
It is kind of surprising, but there's a really bad biology of sedentary behavior, it turns out. It contributes to inflammation. It leads to higher good cholesterol, lower levels of good cholesterol, and obviously can help build weight. It's not so much, if you're sitting for 4 hours, say 4 or 6 hours straight without getting up, I think is the problem. The message sort of is if you are working in a situation where you're at your desk a lot, you know, get up every 30 minutes, take a walk. Instead of sending an email to a colleague across the room, just go over and have a conversation with him or her. So it's not devastating, but it is kind of a surprise that even if you get up in the morning, get on your treadmill for 30 minutes, and you think you've bought your exercise or done your exercise for the day, and then if you just go sit around and do almost nothing, you kind of unwound all of that benefit that you got in the morning.
Well, and this comes from many different sources. The University of Missouri had those stats we were talking about people who have non-exercise activity. You know, you work in a store and you stand up. You're moving more than someone at a desk. You burn more calories. And then there's Peter Katzmarzik. He's at Pennington, the country's leading obesity research center. He says people gain 16 pounds on average within 8 months of starting sedentary office work. And you looked into some research from Australian researchers. They published this about 2 years ago about people who spent time in front of computers and televisions. What did they find?
So they looked at about 8,800 people. They followed them for an average of 6 years. And those who watch TV for more than 4 hours a day were 46% more likely to die of any cause and 80% more likely to die of cardiovascular disease than those who reported spending less than 2 hours a day in front of the tube. It's one of those things you need to get up, you know, change the channel instead of hitting the remote, although I don't know if you can do that anymore with TVs.
I'm not even sure you can. You mentioned the 30-minute workout. That is what scientists say should be your goal.
Right. Yeah. 30 minutes a day is sort of in the recommendations, two and a half to three and a half hours a week.
But then as we've been hearing, just moving helps. So give us some of the stats. You write that 30-minute exercise target cuts your chances of having heart disease by about 70%. I mean, that's huge. But a 10-minute walk does what?
So a 10-minute walk actually reduces your risk for bad heart problems by about 50%.
That's amazing.
So essentially, I think a lot of us might see that 30 minutes a day thing or, you know, got to do 3 or 4 hours a week. You've got a very busy schedule. You say, gee, you know what? I just can't get that in today. And you sort of take it on an all or nothing. If you can't hit the target, then you don't even try. And researchers at the Mayo Clinic sort of looked at the curve which shows that 70-75% benefit of 30 minutes. You go midway down the curve and you know, you still have a significant reduction in risk.
Yeah.
Don't want to be too overstate this too much, but that's measured against people who have very little activity. And it also, the biggest benefit is for the people who have the highest risk. So if you're a really active person regularly, I don't think you should, this isn't advice to cut back necessarily.
Right. So a brisk walk, 10 minutes a day, can still help cut your risk of heart disease by 50%, which isn't bad. And you mentioned, you know, some of the things that are recommended are getting up and going to talk to someone instead of sending an email. Some of us here have asked for stand-up desks. Some people are actually standing on treadmills at their desks. But even just a stand-up desk, just standing up, does that count as movement?
It does. Just getting up, the benefit begins. One of the doctors I talked to said she was in a hotel room, and I think had ironed a blouse or something and left the ironing board up. She came in, had some work to do on her computer. Instead of sitting down at the desk, she set up the computer on the ironing board and stood up. She said, 90 minutes later, she got all her work done, and she was, still upright. And, you sort of think about building little strategies into your routine.
Well, let's move on to some of the other things you mentioned. You say there are two important indicators, and everybody should know their numbers on this: cholesterol, good and bad, and high blood pressure.
Correct. Ideally, your LDL cholesterol, which is the bad cholesterol, should be 100 or lower. If you're in really good health, it can be a little higher than that, but that would be the ideal target. Good cholesterol or HDL, you want to be above 40, and once you get it above 60, you get added benefit. And blood pressure, you want below 120 over 80.
Yeah, and we're not going to get into the different ways that you can bring those numbers down or up when it comes to the good cholesterol. But, there's diet, of course, there's exercise, there's meditation, there's all sorts of things, and people can look into it, but those are the numbers. You know, you cite other stats that make us wonder what the concern is, because you say deaths from coronary heart disease in the U.S. have been cut by 75% in the last 40 years. Is that surprising to people? Because it feels like we might be moving less because we're sitting at computers.
Well, that's a good question. You know, we've had significant progress since the late 60s. And the first Surgeon General's report, which cited the hazards of smoking, came out in the early 60s. And so our death rate from coronary heart disease peaked at about 1968, and it's come down substantially since then. A big portion of that, people say, is for smoking. Mm-hmm. There is a significant part of the population that at least works harder on both on diet and exercise. We have also had some pretty remarkable medications developed over the past two or three decades that have helped mitigate that risk, although every doctor will tell you that your first line of defense is a healthy, right, healthy living style. But so all these things are among the contributors to this. And another thing that's been kind of interesting is the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, some of the groups like Kaiser Permanente have established these guideline programs where you have a protocol of things that you follow, where doctors do. If you get admitted to a hospital with a heart problem, there's a whole protocol that kicks in, which includes working on how to prevent the next one. And so heart attack admissions have gone down substantially in the last decade. And a lot of people think it's just people are looking at the science and following it better.
We're speaking with Ron Winslow. He's Deputy Bureau Chief and Senior Writer for Health and Science at the Wall Street Journal. His story is titled "The Guide to Beating a Heart Attack." He's aggregated all the new research. And Ron, you were just saying that guidelines that are in place for dealing with people who've had heart problems are just one of the reasons hospitals are seeing fewer heart attack victims in the last decade. But you also point out that there are fewer heart attacks among the elderly. Now, that number's fallen by nearly 25% in the last few years. And that's where experts were worried that there'd be almost a tsunami of heart attacks because we have such a large elder population. But they've thankfully not had as many heart attacks.
Right. And that's where some of this guideline work has come in. But, the worry now is that with obesity so prevalent in society, with the rise in diabetes, which is a huge risk factor for heart attack and stroke, that a lot of this progress that we have made is in jeopardy of being reversed.
Well, we might be seeing that in another stat. While heart attacks are going down among the elderly, they're going up among the young, according to a cardiologist and chief of preventive medicine at Northwestern, Donald Lloyd-Jones. You spoke with him as well. Why are there more heart attacks in people in their 20s and 30s?
This does relate to the rise of diabetes and obesity. It's long been known that coronary disease, the disease that leads to heart attacks, the buildup of fatty deposits in the walls of your blood vessels, begins at an early age, in adolescence, if not earlier. There's great concern about our diets and our lack of physical activity at that age that's leading to a sort of an acceleration of the development of disease in earlier and earlier. So there's not really much data on that, but I was kind of surprised by the comment from Dr. Lloyd-Jones. He said every cardiologist he talks to has sort of made the observation that suddenly some younger and younger people are showing up in the hospitals with a heart attack.
Well, but then some of the other stats for those, you know, trying to prevent a heart attack, within a year of quitting smoking, a former smoker's heart attack risk is reduced by 50%. You cut it right in half. Knowing your stats, like your cholesterol and blood pressure, is good to also track how you're doing, if it's going up or going down, which is another way to try to control this. But what about genetics? I mean, aren't there people, no matter what they do, they're going to have markers, genetic markers for heart attacks?
It is one of the, conundrums of medicine. I mean, we all know people who don't take care of themselves at all and seem to dodge every bullet that comes their way. And there are people who take care of themselves intensely, and they have a problem. They have a heart attack. So genetics is a part of it. A lot of people also think it's the interaction of genetics and environment. Nevertheless, there is quite a lot you can do, even if you've drawn a bad hand genetically, to stave off the risk or stave off a heart attack. And again, you just sort of have to take a little bit of extra care and making sure you're taking care of yourself.
A woman who identified herself as an emergency room physician of 23 years wrote a comment after your article in the Wall Street Journal, and she said, 75% of the heart attacks that I care for are patients who are smokers or obese. She said, yes, there are people who have unlucky genes. They've done everything right. They still have a heart attack, but they're the exception. The rule is people who are smokers or obese. Now, we're not saying that obesity isn't also genetic on occasion, or even addiction to smoking may not have some genetic component. But it sounds as if, you know, those are two things that people can do something. She's saying those are two things people can do something about.
I think the really big issue a lot of people are focusing on is intervening at a very early age. People who develop obesity in their teens or earlier, or in very young adults, it's very hard biology to reverse. And so the real best strategy is to prevent this from happening at the beginning, because it really takes on a life of its own.
Well, and we want to touch on one last thing that you discovered in your research. If you want to fight heart disease, apparently you should smile. You say this is kind of shaky science, but tell us about the baseball player research.
Sure. So there was some research from Wayne State University, where people looked at a collection of baseball photographs in a publication called Baseball Digest, I believe it was, who played before 1950. So they had all these photographs and they assembled them and they looked to see how long they lived. And they categorized them by whether there were smiling faces, whether there was sort of a partial smile, and whether there was a broad smile. The broader your smile, the longer you lived after those photographs were taken. And as I said, it's not the best, most rigorous science you could imagine, but it does, it is supported, or it does reflect other research that shows if you're a happy person, if you have an optimistic outlook, if you have a purpose in your life, your risk of a heart disease is lower. Even with the good outlook and you happen to get heart disease, it doesn't progress as fast or you recover sooner.
Well, and we know that the opposite is true, that if you are hostile or angry, you can feel it in your heart. You can feel it.
For sure. Yeah, and there's some pretty interesting data around that, too. If doctors, this is a study at Duke a number of years ago, but doctors who scored high on a hostility scale or on an anger scale were much more likely to die after 25 years than doctors who scored, on a much lower on that scale. So, yeah, I mean, that almost makes sense. You can sort of feel it sometimes if you're constantly angry or constantly at odds with the world. There's a lot of stress involved in that. A lot of it's not good for your blood pressure. It's not good for lots of things.
Right. So, well, Ron Winslow, Deputy Bureau Chief for Health and Science at the Wall Street Journal, I must go because I'm going to get on my treadmill in front of my computer and grin.
There you go.
Try to offset all this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You've probably heard of Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website that lets entrepreneurs and artists raise money from total strangers. People post a video explaining their project and then ask for money. We're going to hear the music of Amanda Palmer. What you see in her video is her holding signs saying, "Fund me." Indie singer Amanda Palmer raised more than $600,000 with her most recent Kickstarter campaign. That'll enable her to record an album and go on tour without a major label. In the coming days, we're going to talk to Tom Rush, who's hoping to kickstart a big anniversary concert down the road. But the most successful Kickstarter campaign so far has been the Pebble Watch. It's a digital watch that syncs with your smartphone so you can read emails and texts on your wrists and control your music and other apps on your phone through your watch. If you want in on this company, though, you're out of luck. They just pulled the Kickstarter campaign after raising more than $10 million. That's right, $10 million from complete strangers who will not get any money back in interest for their investment. They will get a watch. 25-year-old Eric Mijakovsky is the founder of Pebble Watch. He joins us from Palo Alto, California. Eric, congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Remind us how this works, because when you go on Kickstarter with these projects, you have a set amount of time. It's not unlimited. And we mentioned people kick in, and they're not investors. They're usually getting something in return. So what was your original goal?
Our original goal was to raise about $100,000 over 1 month. And within 2 hours, we'd raised $100,000.
And are these just people who are contributing to get a watch in return? You know, what? How did you set up your deal, so to speak?
We structured our Kickstarter so that the first 200 people to pledge to support us would receive a watch in exchange for about $99, which we thought was great, but then that soon filled up and people started paying $115 for a watch.
We know you built a prototype for this watch while still in school, but what happened? Could you not get venture capitalists?
So we had a few angel investors sign on board, and from there we kept working hard on our product. We got feedback from early users. But when we had Pebble fully designed, we went out and attempted to raise capital from venture capitalists, and we just were unable to get any hard yeses. So we decided to take the project to the crowd using Kickstarter.
And we should say this, they're not investing in an idea. You just said there's a watch out there. It works. It's almost, again, I always refer to the brooms in the Mickey Mouse scene in Fantasia, you know, as the brooms keep splitting. As you're seeing this, are you starting to think, wait a minute, so many people are investing and expecting a watch back. We have to make these watches.
Luckily, we had a couple different plans. We actually had an option to go to a contract manufacturer overseas that is able to manufacture a lot more watches.
And as we said, there's a time frame on Kickstarter where you have to stop. If you don't raise the money you need, you have to give it back. You had the opposite problem. You're raising almost too much money, and so you had to pull the plug yourself?
Yeah, that was one of the decisions. It was a pretty hard decision that we made last week. But we knew that our Kickstarter backers, over 60,000 people that have supported us so far, those were our prime objectives. So over the next 4 months, we're going to be working practically 24/7 to make those people as happy as possible with their Pebble when they get it. And one of the things that we had to do to make them as happy was actually stop taking more orders right now and focus on the people that we have.
So to date, over 1.75 million people have given more than $185 million to 20,000 projects on Kickstarter. You, of course, have raised the most money. Do you think this is shattering the venture capital model, you know, the idea of having to go hat in hand to venture capitalists?
I would say that this model of using Kickstarter acts as a complement to the standard VC fundraising model. One of the cool things about Kickstarter is that it's not an equity financing round. It's really just early customers that you're gaining for your product or service.
That's Eric Mijakovsky, founder of the Pebble Watch. They raised a record-breaking $10 million on Kickstarter. By the way, Eric, is there a project on Kickstarter you'd invest in?
Oh, yeah. One of the really cool things about Kickstarter is you could actually see what each project creator has already invested in. I invested in this really cool case for an iPad. You put your iPad into this case, and it becomes an Etch-A-Sketch.
Oh.
And I just put $45 in for that this week.
Timely, too, for the election season. Eric.
Actually, that was one of the things that they talked about.
Eric, thanks so much, and best of luck to you.
Thanks very much.
The Federal Reserve Bank of New York says new research shows there are more than 6 million Americans age 50 and older still paying off student loans, totaling $133 billion. Of course, some of these adults have co-signed a loan with a child, but some are trying to pay their own loans that go back decades. Many of them are delinquent, and it's not uncommon for people, even into their 80s, to be harassed by debt collectors or to see their Social Security checks or paychecks garnished. We have some stats from a nonprofit that helps students. In 2008 alone, the U.S. Department of Education, through the Treasury, garnished $62 million from the Social Security checks of retirees to pay for defaulted federal student loans. This is happening while there's a partisan battle over how to keep interest rates for new federal student loans from doubling. And Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois is pushing legislation that would allow private student loan debt to be discharged in bankruptcy. Right now, even if you declare bankruptcy, you can't discharge student loan debt, private or government. Sandy Burnett of Illinois joins us. Sandy, you're 58. Do we understand you are still struggling to pay off student loans from the 1980s?
Yes.
How did this happen? This was grad school debt that you acquired in the 80s. What happened? Why couldn't you pay it off?
The year I graduated, you could practice as a licensed counselor. However, my field was clinical psychology and not just counseling, and you couldn't practice as a clinical psychologist with a master's. You had to have a PhD. Mm. So I taught, and I taught part-time for 9 years, at the local junior college, but never attaining a tenure or a full-time position that would increase my salary over, let's say, $5,000 to $8,000 a year as a part-time teacher.
Yeah. The loan that you took out for grad school is about $21,000, again, so you could pursue a master's degree in clinical psychology. This is in the 80s. You had work, but it never paid more than $25,000 a year. You started to fall behind on your payments, so now I'm assuming that you're gathering fees and penalties.
Many.
Yeah.
My student loan debt now is $53,000.
Oh, my gosh, from what was $21,000.
Correct.
Well, and by the way, who is your lender? Was it a private bank? Was it the government?
Most of it was the Pell Grant and the Staffordshire loan.
These are Stafford loans, Pell Grants for moderate and low-income students.
Right.
Yeah. And along the path to this $53,000, you also, your husband died.
Correct. He died in 2003.
Yeah. So you're really getting hit here. $53,000. What is happening to you? Are you having payments garnished?
Yes, I am. They're taking 15% of my pay each week, and I get paid every 2 weeks, and that results in about 650 to, let's say, 7.25 every 2 weeks that I get.
That's got to hurt. You're working as a customer service representative, so you have a job, but that much money out every 2 weeks, what effect has that had?
I managed to pay my lot rent. I live in a 1986 mobile home. I pay my gas, my electricity, my telephone, my insurance, and then it's an option of whether I'm paying gas to get back and forth to work or do I eat.
Well, and we understand that after your husband died, you did file for bankruptcy, but as we said, that you can't lose this student debt in bankruptcy.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, after we mentioned on the air that we were going to be talking to you, we heard from a nonprofit called American Student Assistance. They're based right here in Boston. They help people manage higher education debt. They say you can appeal garnishments based on financial circumstance. That you can go back to loan holders. They might remove the garnishment order after you make a certain number of voluntary payments. Have you tried to renegotiate this loan with your lender?
I applied for hardship and they denied me.
Oh, so you did apply to your lender saying that you had hardship and they denied you.
Correct. Well, because I can't make the payment they want.
How much were they asking?
Well, they want like $400 or $500 a month payment. And I just can't do that. I mean, I don't have that kind of money.
We understand you don't have running water.
My kitchen faucet is broken down. I don't have running water in my kitchen. I have a washer dryer, but the pump's out of the washer, and the dryer's got a heating element out of it. I've got plywood floors so I don't fall through the front room floor. I got glasses this spring, but it took me 3 months at $20 a month to get the $60 to get the glasses that I needed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's just useless. It's just useless.
And it sounds like, in some ways, so was your education. I mean, do you find yourself thinking you didn't even get the job that this, you know, 21,000 in student debt was supposed to pay for.
Right. I wish I'd never went to graduate school. I mean, I truly do, because I can't get a job at McDonald's, and I have tried because I have a graduate degree. It has been more of a liability. It has been a total liability than any sort of advantage.
Do you understand, Sandy, that people might be saying, yeah, this is just a terrible story, and yet, you know, you took out the loan. I mean, should the lenders just let you default on what was $21,000 but it's now $53,000?
I don't think that loans should be given for programs that you can't get a job to pay the loans back.
Well, and there is a push in Congress to make colleges, especially online colleges, base their federal funding on their success in getting students jobs. It sounds like you'd be in favor of that.
I had an interview last fall at a college about 90 miles away to teach. I'm still trying to get that tenure position to teach somewhere.
Yeah.
And I have an education. I would love to use it. I have a ton of variety of experience. I feel real lucky I have a job. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I want to quit the job and just live off the state. I don't want things just given to me, but I don't think things should be promoted for me to take with the expectation that I'm going to be able to give it back because of such a wonderful thing that's going to happen to me by getting an education.
That's 58-year-old Sandy Barnett of Illinois, who the education she's speaking of was in the grad school in the late 80s. She took out a $21,000 loan to get a master's degree in clinical psychology. She never got the job, and that loan is now ballooned to $53,000. Sandy, best of luck to you.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate talking with you.
The Russian national anthem, played as Vladimir Putin was inaugurated as president this week. We heard the applause in the hall, but Putin's motorcade to the ceremony drove through what one Russian writer called a ghost town because police had cleared Moscow streets out of fear of more protests. Protests with the whiff of a Russian spring not only dogged Putin, they surprised Russia experts who were expecting him to waltz back into office. It's the latest in a long line of surprising turns in recent Russian and Eastern European history. But our next guest says events like these only seem surprising because we're listening to the experts. He says to understand events in Russia and neighboring countries like Ukraine and Georgia, you must read the great Russian writers. Thomas DeWall is author of The Caucasus, An Introduction. He joins us from the Carnegie Endowment Studios in Washington. And Tom, you match three countries with three works of literature, so let's do that. Start with Nikolai Gogol's play, The Government Inspector. Why don't you give us the thumbnail and then tell us what we should read into that?
It's a tale of a small Russian unnamed provincial town and a very corrupt mayor. So nothing new there. And nothing works. There are geese nesting in the courtroom. Everyone is on the take. And then suddenly they hear a rumor that a government inspector has arrived from the capital. Everyone is, of course, terrified. The whole town is turned upside down. And then they make their mistake. They mistake for the government inspector this young man staying at the inn. He realizes quickly that this is a case of mistaken identity, and he exploits them, just has a wonderful time eating the mayor's meals, seducing his daughter, everyone giving him little gifts, and then when he fears he's about to be rumbled, he skips town. Everyone's in consternation because they suddenly realize they've been duped, and at the end of the play, announcement is made that the real government inspector has arrived, and there's this famous dumb scene in which everyone is completely dumbstruck.
So when he says at the end of the play, the mayor turns and says to everyone else on stage, what are you laughing at? You are laughing at yourself. Is that Gogol speaking directly to the audience?
It is. I think he's speaking to the whole of Russia, and I think it's a critique of the whole of Russia. You could call the system authoritarianism by consent, and that's basically what Putin's Russia is as well. It doesn't work unless everyone decides to go along with the system and not to rock the boat.
You write about another connection between the two. You say, you know, the inspector's a fraud, right? It's this young guy running around fooling everybody. And so the president in Russia might be.
Yeah, I think Gogol's put his finger on something which a lot of political scientists haven't, which is that the system is very brittle. It's reliant on one man, on personalized power. It can crumble very quickly, and that's what we saw with the Soviet Union in 1991, and we've seen it on a smaller scale suddenly with the seemingly invincible Vladimir Putin challenge this year. And I think we see that in the famous dumb scene at the end of Gogol's play, that suddenly this great vertically erected system can fall apart and you have almost instant chaos before someone comes along and reconstitutes it.
So that is the work of literature that you compare to Putin's Russia. Then you move on to Anton Chekhov's play, The Cherry Orchard, and you say this can help explain modern-day Ukraine. So again, a thumbnail of The Cherry Orchard, perhaps people more familiar with this, and then Ukraine.
Well, Chekhov is, you could call, the master of the mundane. He's a kind of poet of everyday life. You know, there are no dramatic tragedies in his stories. The Cherry Orchard is all about this estate in present-day eastern Ukraine with a famous cherry orchard, and the rather feckless lady landowner can't really afford to keep it up. She's come back from Paris and deciding what to do with it. It's the beginning of the 20th century. The servants are no longer so subservient. There's a new player in town who's a businessman who used to be a serf. So the economic order is changing. There's a whole wonderful cast of characters. At the end, the estate is sold, the cherry orchard is chopped down, and everyone disperses. The genius of the play is that it's really how you look at it. It could be a tragedy if you see the passing of the old order. It could be a celebration of the new order of economic justice, or it could be a bit of both. You see it through a spectrum of different characters, which I think is why it's still a compelling play to watch. Why Ukraine? Because Chekhov's famous for everyone talking past each other, no one agreeing, the conversation goes on. We, the audience, see everyone missing the point. The people with the money aren't very good at expressing themselves. The people that are expressing themselves don't have any money. And it's all a bit of a comedy. It's not tragic. And you look at Ukraine, it's a country of 45 million people in terms of land area, the largest European country. And yet it's a country which is completely misses its potential, where people don't really push together. The people with the money, again, don't have the ideas. The people with the ideas don't have the money. It kind of stumbles on. It's a bit of a disappointment, but it's not a tragedy.
You quote others saying it's lost in transition. It was supposed to be a sort of dynamic bridge between Europe and Russia.
So it's a kind of gray zone in between. It's neither Europe nor Russia.
You know, we did watch the Orange Revolution there, and we saw this very exciting woman emerge, the woman with the braid around her head.
Who's now in jail.
Who's been jailed. So there's drama.
There's drama in Chekhov, too, but it's drama without resolution. The Orange Revolution brought a lot of drama, and then who happens to be president now, but the guy who lost the Orange Revolution. So everything changes and nothing changes, which I'm afraid is the story of Ukraine.
Then you bring us to perhaps the most dramatic comparison, the great Dostoevsky novel, The Brothers Karamazov, written in the 19th century, considered one of the greatest novels ever written, and you say it helps us understand present-day Georgia.
Georgia is the opposite of Ukraine. It's a country that proceeds through drama, through confrontation, a very theatrical, dramatic people, which is why it's fun to be there, but sometimes its politics veers into disaster. The Brothers Karamazov is a novel about the patricide. It's about killing the father, and this is really what Georgia confronted as the Soviet Union broke up. It slew the Russian father, and it also slew the memory of the Russian-Georgian-Soviet parent, Stalin. Since 2004, we've had the youngest government in Europe.
And they're 20 and 30-somethings. I mean, it is young.
Exactly. And you meet these people, and they're bright-eyed, full of passionate ideas. Reformers, but they're not really Democrats. They're so possessed by their ideas, they don't really want to discuss them. They know that they're right, and they're going to push them through. And the old generation can go hang if they don't agree. So it's all about reform, with capital R, rather than democracy. These were Dostoevskian radical revolutionaries trying to build a utopia and cutting corners in the process. Ivan Karamazov, who's not yet 30 and has already come up with this utopian theory for the future, really could be transplanted into the current day Georgian government.
There you have it. Three great works, three countries, three ways of looking at Russia and two countries that have split off through literature. Do you think this is unique to Russian literature?
In Russia, more than pretty much any other society I can think of, literature has a kind of social role. There's this group of people in society who think deeply about the world, who are great writers, but they're not really connected to the political life of the country, and that makes them more free, it makes them think harder, and it gives them this very important role. And even 19th century England or the US would have had, you know, an active press, active political class. And in Russia, you've got more of these kind of isolated figures. Tolstoy or Dostoevsky were giants within the society. And you go back to them and you see very deep insights into Russian society and Russian development as well.
That's Thomas Duval at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's with the Russia and Eurasia program. His latest book is The Caucasus, an Introduction. And we'll also link you to his article on viewing countries through Russian literature. Tom, thanks so much.
Great to talk to you.